This is the voice of Carnage, and you are listening to Carnage Cast.
Hi everyone, welcome to episode 16 of Carnage Cast. Nick Palmer, former Carnage staffer and GM on the New England convention circuit, talks about some of his doings at Carnage in Wonderland, including a three-table Call of Cthulhu game, awesomeness versus accessibility, and other role-playing topics. Afterward, Chuck, Robert, and Rod cut into Dominant Species for Autopsy of a Game. Players compete to secure resources and living space for their particular class of animals, arachnids, insects, and more. Plus, we learn the dark secret of the Kill J phase. And now, here's Nick Palmer.
Now, interview with the gamer.
Hi, I'm sitting here with Nick Palmer, longtime Carnage attendee, former staffer, former president, 2007 best tabletop GM of the year as decided by the voting masses and orchestrated in TotalCon. Hi, Nick. How are you?
I feel small now. I should be bigger. I'm good. Thank you. Good morning.
Thanks for coming.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. This is kind of fun.
I'm glad to hear it. So it's Sunday morning of Carnage. Where are you energy-wise?
I'm actually okay. After that introduction, I feel pumped and ready to go. I want to go like run an event right now. But yeah, I feel pretty good. The hour change is such a blessing to be able to get that extra hour. Woo. Thank you for doing illogical time changes, U.S. government.
I'm sure they're happy to oblige. You having a good convention so far?
Yes, sir. Definitely. I was really looking forward to it this year and made the early trip up and got right in with Friday afternoon and big event. And that seemed to set the stage for the rest of the convention.
Yes, your 3GM event. What can you tell us more about that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. We ran a three-table event. I have been blood sworn to secrecy fear of the wrath of the mighty Cthulhu. So I have to not give you specific details, but suffice to say, what everybody saw was a bunch of people running from table to table with blindfolds on and lots of antics and fun as they jumped around. The table of players I started with was not the table of players that I ended with, which was very interesting for me as a GM. And in the end, they managed to finish off the event in a somewhat satisfactory manner.
Cool. What kind of interaction between tables was happening?
This was an interesting mechanic. Last year, after the theme for this year, Down the Rabbit Hole was announced, we were thinking, brainstorming outside on Sunday, just talking amongst ourselves, Gaylord from the board and myself and a few of the attendees. And one of the things that we came up with was that it would be really interesting to have a multi-dimension or multi-table type event where we could either talk to other tables or maybe even, you know, swap GMs or swap players or do something like that. That would be fun. You know, we could play with that whole portal, mirror, looking glass, alternate world kind of deal. And when we did that, we we're just brainstorming, and a few months later, the primary GM who suggested it, Andre Krupa, he said, I found this module online, and I was just wondering, I think it's really interesting. The mechanic, I had to see what it was about, so I bought it, and, you know, it's really good, so I'm thinking about running it. It's like, perfect. Oh, it was just, it was that alignment. And we did that, and I went and purchased it, and we read through it, and like, oh yeah, we have to do this. So essentially just what happens is the players rotate across different tables. We did manage to get every player swapped at least once or twice. And that gives them a very interestingly and disorienting experience. And all our rooms were very different toned and themed. And we're all three good, but very different GMs. So we were able to explore that idea of being able to switch through the looking glass kind of thing, switch the dimensions and the realities.
Did you get any much feedback from the players in terms of, like, when they would switch from Andre to you, that where they had to reorient and get their bearings on the differences in how you ran games?
Everybody was happy to get out of the screeching clarinet jazz from Andre. That's definitely true, which was wonderful. As soon as he told me what he had, I was like, oh, that's going to be wonderfully grating. I mean, I've done that to players before in games where I've picked up something the end of the game happened for us so suddenly that I didn't have a chance to even think about playing the music that I had. Mm-hmm. It's music that is ultra low frequency death drone. And seriously, when I've played with players who have sensitive ears and are musicians and that mm-hmm. sort of thing, I've played this and had it just going in the background, and it's so low and so deep and rumbly and nasty that it really does make you physically feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And if you've got a sensitive ear to tone, it really grates on you. I've had players when they were invading Dagon's lair as the end of one of those big campaigns.
Like you do.
And yeah, you do. And I was playing this music there, and they eventually, after about 45 minutes, said, hey, I really can't play with this. It's really making it uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. So I had to turn it off. But that's the stuff that I like putting on for those moments as well.
Okay. Yeah, you are renowned as being one of those people who really sets up the environment that players are in with the visuals and the auditory aids as well.
Yeah, I've found that it's you just need a few details. You know, you can go as limited or as far as you want. One of the things that's still sitting on my shelf that I'm nervous to bring out is from one of the Gnome Stew Sinister Forces blog guy, Patrick mm-hmm. Benson, and he says, okay. You know, use a telescoping retractor. You would use it to pick up screws.
Yeah.
I bought mine at an auto supply store. And you can use it as a sword or as a wand or as a pointer or whatever. He said it's one of the best GM tools. And I've got that. And I still don't know if I want to bring that out, like as a prop. I'm kind of nervous to pull that out. But if you pick a good couple details, mm-hmm. Which is the point, you find something that's very easy or functional for you to do, and you exploit that to your advantage. And yeah, Gaylord, myself, Andre, other GMs, all different styles, all good GMs, find something that works for you. And I like doing for, you know, my D&D and Pathfinder and, you know, D20 type stuff. I like having those good visuals on the table. Mm-hmm. You got to make sure that you have that so that it really brings out that tactical response and exploration of abilities. And I found that was one of the coolest things with being able to do that. So I'm like, all right, well, I got to make sure that I do that and include that. And I think that it does. I think that it actually drives creativity of the players of seeing an environment. And when you've got, you know, the chickens and the goats running around in the courtyard as the bandits are raiding the village, mm-hmm. somebody comes up with a chicken slingshot. and that's a good thing. You know, that's a good thing. You want to see that kind of stuff.
It is. It's awesome. So the players and the props start interacting tactically as well as tactically. And that's firing their imagination as to what they could do with that stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
When you mentioned the low-frequency death metal, it was making players uncomfortable. How do you find you sometimes have to negotiate between what's awesome and what's practical in that way?
That's a good question. I think that it's something that you never want to not shoot for awesome, though. The question is, I think, more of accessibility. Because it could be so completely awesome, but you know what? Your episode or your module or scenario based off of episode 27 of some random anime show that four people in the con are going to know about and love, that's tough unless you get those four people at the table.
Yeah.
So you can go totally awesome in a way that is almost esoteric. And I don't know if I used that word right. And that could become inaccessible. Mm-hmm. So you have to make sure that you include some stuff. I view it as the cheesiness factor. Mm-hmm. You know, you can have a lot of cheese, and it can be a good thing or a bad thing. So you got to have, you know, again, making sure that you get that right kind of cheese.
Right.
If it's accessible, then, you know, you always go for awesome as far as you can. And again, find the way that it works for you, though. And you find that niche, and you find that point, and you move towards that and really try to refine that. And over years, you develop a very good knack and flavor for it. I've been GMing for 32 years, mm-hmm. and that's a long time. You develop a little bit of skills and tricks.
Your instincts develop over that time, particularly when you're doing it as often and with such a varied audience as you are. Because you get out to a lot of different conventions, right?
I try to, yeah. My time is more limited these years with my other hobbies, mm-hmm. so that makes it difficult. But I make it a point now to get to Gen Con. That's an important trip for me to do now. And that's for working on my own stuff and just trying to really be inspired. Yeah, I went to a lot of cons and I played in a lot of great games and tried a lot of things that didn't work. And, you know, I remember one game where there's a set of players that I still see to cons to this day, but they'll never come into one of my games because they had such a bad experience up in the crow's nest at Ascutney for one game I ran. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I took on, for one of my very first convention games, I took on 10 players in a Call of Cthulhu adventure, and I failed miserably. Mm-hmm. And I have not seen any of those players. I've seen them at cons, but not back at my table. So, right. I mean, it can happen. It totally can happen. And that was one of those times of shooting for awesome, but making it too inaccessible.
Right.
You know, so you learn, and you make those mistakes, and you grow, and you get better. And I think I completely lost the point of the question.
I think you're fine. So when you're at Gen Con, what are you doing?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, going to the different cons. Yes, name dropping. I think that my favorite local New England convention, aside from Carnage, for obvious personal bias reasons, has got to be the Intercon Alphabet Series. I think they're at Intercon L now.
Yep.
And that's in March. It's a great convention for being inspired as a GM. All theatrical, LARPing, a lot of great costumes, and a lot of really, really cool mechanics and events mm-hmm. for these live-action theatrical events. So I don't get to go to that one because it conflicts with the Can-Am Crown Sled Dog Race. So
okay.
Don't get to go anymore.
Right.
That is great. And then I decided that it was time to start getting to Gen Con. So we go there, and I am planning on running a few games, and I am an old trade show veteran professionally.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to work the floor. I want to make a booth and get that going. So hopefully we'll see that happen this next year.
So you're running and networking?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay.
I would just suggest to people to not plan on anything their first time going to Gen Con.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing as Burning Man. Like, don't plan on anything. Just go and just experience it. And when you go back the second time, you're going to have a really, really, really cool time because you'll know exactly what you want to do and you'll be able to plan.
Right.
But until you really get there and you see what 30,000 gamers inhabiting the center mm-hmm. of a city looks like, and realizing that although all the role-playing games are in the hotel that you're staying in, all the indie role-playing games, which is what you're running, are on the exact opposite corner, and it's going to be a 25-minute walk to get to your table, as opposed to going down to the lobby. You figure that stuff out, and you know, and you can plan and adjust and really have a great experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I go there because I want to play, which I do. I go there because I want to run, because I enjoy it, and so I do. And I go there because it's a really, really great time for meeting people and for developing other areas of interest in the craft and hobby.
Mm-hmm. What other areas of interest in particular are you thinking about?
Oh, definitely self-publishing. I've explored that a little bit, and this next year is the year for concentrating on that and making that happen.
Cool. What's your first project?
We are updating some of the existing modules that we've already produced, polishing them up a little bit, changing formats around based on feedback that we got, updating player handouts and maps, which we had in there, but they weren't really, really accessible, I think. So again, it's accessibility thing.
Right.
So making the material just more accessible and format-wise, and also getting some systems put into it as well, because they had no systems and stats on them. So we're going to actually put some stats and systems in there.
Okay, so these are the modules that date from the RPG Bomb days, right?
Oh, yeah. Those, as well as a lot of other stuff that we've worked on individually. But that modern game world, which I enjoy playing in, is something that we want to try to develop because it seems to be where most of our interest is. We're Shadowrun and modern superhero favorites, my partner Drew and I, and that is something that always comes out in what we do. Yeah, I think that Shadowrun and superheroes are probably the two things that we did the most together, and that modern game world with a good paranormal and horror flavor,
is
what I really like working on. I think mm-hmm. it's the richest and again most accessible material for people. With self-publishing, we're taking the approach, I believe, at this point in time. We haven't signed the work orders yet because it's for 2012, but it's close.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at more of a web free content and then additional material purchase content. Mm-hmm. It's something that is, I think, going to be a good model and a way that we can have smaller creative projects as well as bigger production goals and deadlines to put into place as well. And that's something for me that makes the idea exciting, because I can whip out that one character that I've been working on and we can put that out and, you know, get some art and some layout around it and have that up as content and develop that on the site, as well as then put those characters and elements and things into stories and expand those out.
Right.
So the idea is to have the teasers and the free content and then these more developed adventure books and modules to go along with it. And if we work it out well, which is doable, I think that they will be very easily transferable to anything from space opera to steampunk. And that's something that, again, making it adaptable and usable. Having an old taken over ghost town is really something you can do in just about any setting and fits into it from, yeah, you know, Wild West on up to a remote outpost in deep space.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you're taking a software app tiered approach to creating and publishing content.
Well, you look at what's out there and you pick what seems to be appealing to you and what's been successful. And yeah, that's something, you know, it's not a secret. It's not a fairly novel invention. It's something that's been tried and proven and works for a lot of people. So yeah, definitely.
Okay. If people want to know more, where can they be looking for news about this or your own other projects?
You know, strangely, I'm a recruiting professional in my day job, so my page is on LinkedIn, and that's where I have all links to Onscribed for, you know, content and material, and we'll have links to the website on there as soon as that goes live in early 2012. So that's the plan, and my LinkedIn page is Nick Palmer. I'm the recruiter Nick Palmer, and musher, and gamer, and kickboxer guy. So look for that, Nick Palmer. And and that's NikPalmer. And you can also search me on any social media. I'm Spong. And that's Sierra Papa Oscar November Golf. SPONNG. Spong.
Roger.
Next, we take you to an autopsy of a game.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Autopsy of a Game. My name's Tyler, and with me are...
Rod.
Chuck.
Robert.
And today we're going to talk about Dominant Species, which is a board game from GMT Games. Rod, correct. Why don't you tell us about this?
First thing is that Dominant Species is a game about the species on Earth and their fight for survival. That's the theme of it. In general, it's a worker placement game where you will be choosing actions. You have a certain amount of actions or workers, well, not workers in this case, but more action pawns, to choose your actions, to build your species, make them the dominant species on the board. What you get in the game is a bunch of wooden, it's a six-player game. There are six wooden player pieces in various colors, signifying your species, which are cubes, dominance, which we'll get into later, which are cones, and your action pawns, which are round drum-like.
Cylinders.
Cylinders, correct. Thank you.
And each of those different colors is a different phylum, right?
Correct. And you play reptiles, mammals, insects, birds, amphibians, and arachnids. Those are the six species you can play. They each have a different, it's not truly asymmetrical, but they all have a different ability that they can do throughout the game that affects different actions that you might take.
Okay. How does the game start off?
Well, it starts with certain species in play. You have one of each type of land out there. You have wetlands, savanna, deserts, mountains, forests, and jungles, and as well as seas, but the initial sea is covered in ice. It's a tundra.
So it's post-ice age?
It is post-ice age. There is an action that allows you to ice things over. There will be ice ages going on. Different terrain will be changed into tundra as it goes along, and of course species don't live as well in tundra. But basically, you start with a certain number of species out on the board in areas that you control with elements that allow them to survive. The elements are meat, sun, seeds, water, I call them grubs, but I guess that's, I think that's what they are, shrimp or grubs, and grasslands. And those are the elements that the various species need to survive. And they have to have matching elements on their cards as well as on the board to allow a species to survive in a certain area.
Mm-hmm.
So we start. You start with a certain number of species out on the board, certain dominance on the board in certain areas. And then you have three actions to begin with. And you start in what they call food chain order, the mammals going last because they are highest on the food chain and the insects going first.
Mm-hmm.
And they place their action pawns on the board, on the action spaces, to perform the various actions that you're going to choose from.
Which looks like a pretty long list.
It is an extremely long list. I think going into all of them would probably be a little bit boring and tedious, so I'm just going to give you some highlights of things you can do. There are actions that allow you, there's adaptation, which allows you to take in more elements so that your species can adapt and live in different areas where different elements are. Regression happens after that, where you regress, actually, where, sometimes we don't all evolve at the same time, and so you lose some elements so that your species can't live in certain areas. So it's kind of a give and a take there. There's wanderlust, which allows you to place new terrain on the board, and that will happen every turn, just about, and you can move your species into that area. So there's migration also, where you can move your species into other areas. There's speciation, where you grow more species into areas where you're allowed to grow.
Mm-hmm.
There's competition, where you compete with other species. You can knock them off. Domination is the scoring action that you take. You're scoring the terrains, the terrain tiles. And basically what it is you score for an area based on whether or not how many species you have on that area. There's two important differences between domination and species on a tile. When you're scoring, you are looking at the species on a tile, how many there are. You score based on what type of tile it is. For, like, say, a sea tile, the player that has the most species would score 9 points, 5 for second, 3 for third, 2 for fourth. A lesser
habitat?
Yeah, a lesser habitat, say like a mountain or a tundra, may only score for the first two or only one player. Domination itself, which is important when you're drawing the cards, there are cards in this, and the cards are played and do various things on the board. The species that dominates the tile is the species that matches the most elements on the tile. I spoke about the elements being water, grassland, grubs, seeds, sun, and meat. If your species matches, in other words, the card, we each have a card, and let's say the reptiles dominate a wetlands. If the wetlands has two suns and a grassland on it, and that is what the reptiles have on their card, and they may dominate that area. They may not have the most species there, but they are the dominant species in that particular tile, and that is the person that draws a card from the five that are available. You play a card, after you've established dominance, you choose a card and you play it, and the cards do various things, like catastrophe, select a tile, eliminate all species on it. Your animal and each animal above yours in the food chain gains a new action pawn, which would be intelligence. And each biomes would be one where each animal having more victory points than you loses an amount of victory points equal to the last tile scored. There are various actions that happen with these. And once again, to dominate, all you have to do is have at least one species on. You don't have to have the most species. Domination is a different, and that's probably the hardest part of the game is the difference between scoring, which is the most species, and domination, which is the most elements matching your species. So we go through these rounds and we score, and basically the game will end when all the cards have run out and the Ice Age card is played, and it basically starts the final scoring round where you score based on, again, species, not domination, and the final score will be what it is. There's no one's ever really out of the game, I think. You can always score. There's always people coming from behind. And each of the animals have different abilities that help them in certain areas. For instance, say the arachnid get to compete every time, every turn. So they will eliminate species in certain areas.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. Blood-sucking critters were killing things left and right.
Correct. And various other things. The insects will always speciate. They always add at least one species to an area. So there is a special ability. Sometimes it's a very strong one, for say like the mammals, which extinction is something that happens at the end of each turn. If your species is in an area where there are no matching elements to your species goes extinct in that area. Mammals have the ability to protect one species in an area that's going extinct. So mammals adapt a little better that way. The game plays like a worker placement. You play down your actions, and you're competing for victory points. I think it's got a nice feel for a theme. Actions really bring out the theme, and that you are trying to evolve. You're trying to make your species better. You're trying to make it match more elements. You can migrate to other areas where you can live better. You're trying to dominate different areas. And I really think that brought out in the game. The one drawback, I think, to the game is and it's a drawback that I've heard a lot of people talk about GMT games, is it's not a very pretty game. It's very simplistic. The gameplay is fantastic, but the pieces are could have been a little better.
You mean the board pieces, like the cubes and the cones?
The board pieces, and I believe the art is okay for the terrain. They do have a third edition coming out very soon from GMT, where they've changed the art, and I think the third edition art looks much better. I will keep my second edition game, but I just think that they've really done a nice job with the new art. The art with the third edition, I think, finally comes up to the quality of the gameplay itself.
The artwork does look like it's taken right off from Microsoft Office.
Clip art.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Yeah, it's kind of, the whole board's kind of a pastel, muted, yellowy thing.
It's a very mellow, average artwork.
That's pretty much my attitude towards the whole game.
I agree with Rod that the gameplay is very good. The parts that come with the game make it pretty easy to play once you understand it. There's like where you place the action pawns on it to pick your things. It's pretty much just a sequence of play. It starts with initiative and ends with the domination element, and you just go right down the row. Whoever's action pawn is in the next place to play, you just do his turn. Makes it real easy to play once you understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Play left to right and down.
Yeah, you go down, left to right across each of the rows. You know, whoever's pawns in that spot, and then if they're all out, you go to the next row.
Right.
Makes it pretty simple to play. It's
so it's kind of the same mechanic. What was that game? Europa 3 or something like that?
No, I think you're thinking of Age of Empires.
Age of Empires 3. It's exactly that same kind of mechanic.
Yes.
Where you have the sequence of play right there, and you just go left to right and down. The artwork is something, and it's not really the artwork per se, but it's the pieces I think could have been really jazzed up and would have made the game just that kind of glitzy, just funner to play.
Yep.
Even though I think there's a really good game in here. The one downside for the kind of game it is, because it's worker placement, is that you're looking at 3 hours instead of an hour and a half, which may be a downside for a lot of people.
And I think that the difference between domination and scoring species can confuse people, but I think once you play it, you'll get it pretty quick. It's the first time we played, we kept wanting to go back to the number of species equal domination, and that's not the case.
Right. It's how many the species match up with elements.
With elements on the tile, correct.
Yep.
And once you get that, that is the key point to the game. Once you get that, I think that the game plays really smoothly. With experienced players, I think you can cut the time down some, but even with experienced players, you're still going to have a 2.5, maybe 3 hours. Yeah.
Okay.
It's definitely a Euro-type game, but it's no different than, say, Agricola or Le Havre, which can also take some time and are very deep games.
That explains why I don't like this game very much. I hate Agricola.
Tyler, would you like to comment on that?
I can only agree with Robert, personally. So it's a long game, and it looks like it rewards planning and deep thinking about what's going to happen.
Yes, you can actually plan ahead, but there are things that happen on the cards. That's the random portion of the game. The things that happen with the cards, the actions, will affect your species and the species of others, which can affect how you plan. The one thing that I have noticed, and I think I said this, is that no one's really out of it, because your species, you never really get eliminated. You can always migrate. You can always move to different areas. You find that your species will move, ebb and flow across the board, and you'll be scoring different things. like Age of Empires, there's a lot of different strategies to go for the victory points.
So there's random elements in the game. Does that mean it's sort of like a competitive take that kind of game, or just, oh no, something terrible's happened to all of us?
No. There is certainly take that. I mean, you can pick a card that will affect another species or another player.
But it's controlled because you're choosing the cards to play, and when you want to play them,
correct.
When you get the access to the choice, there's going to be five cards out at any one time, and when it's your turn to choose, you can choose one of those cards to play.
Correct. And you can actually, you can choose one that's not going to affect you as badly, but there are also a lot of cards that will affect everybody. You're going to go through all the cards. All the cards are going to get played in every game,
mm-hmm.
Right up to the Ice Age. They don't ever disappear. They will eventually get played, and that's how the game ends. So, yeah. I mean, it could go quicker if people are drawing cards. The other thing is who takes the domination action will dictate who gets the cards, because it's the player that's dominating whatever tile is scored gets the card. So you could score one that's good for you to score, but you may not be dominating that. So you're giving the card to someone else.
And the choice is that you figure out, do I want to score this tile and get the card for myself, which might be less points, but I'm getting the card, or do I score another tile when giving a lot of points and giving somebody else the card because he actually has the...
As with most games like this, the gameplay actually is pretty smooth and relatively easy to learn. This strategy that's deeper.
Mm-hmm. Counterpoint, Robert?
Well, it combines three elements that I hate. Got a bunch of titles like Settlers of Catan. You've got a huge number of cubes like Die Marker. And you've got the whole process like with way too many ways to win, like you do with Age of Empires 3. So it combines the worst aspects of all three of those games to one game that I would rather not play.
Is there a game that you like, Robert?
Well, yes, I like Endeavor.
We'll have to talk about that someday.
Yeah, no. Actually, I like a lot of games. I found this game
really
long and... Well, okay, I don't like that many games. I'd much rather take the devil's advocate view on every game I play and have to be proved that it's a good game to play. Because there's only so much time to play games. And every time I get together with you guys, you'd rather haul out a new game for me to play than a game that I've learned once.
Well, that's a whole other game.
That's true. But I find this game long, dull, and tedious.
Okay.
There's nothing more to be said about it.
Whereas I find it smooth playing, engaging, and really a fun game to play. With the right people.
People who don't find it long, boring, and tedious.
Correct.
So, Rod, when you're in the game and you're caught up, what specifically is engaging you about the play?
I really enjoy... I like strategy games and deep strategy games. Like, I enjoy Agricola. I enjoy Le Havre. And I like trying to figure out a way to strategize to score the most points. But also, with the cards and various other things that can happen, I mean, even the actions can affect other players. Getting the actions or making sure that a certain element they need is not available is a great interaction, and I love player interaction. That's where it differs from, say, like an Agricola or a Le Havre, which are basically, there's very little player interaction. You're not affecting the other players other than what actions you're taking from them. Whereas in this game, you can directly affect them. Set them back, what have you.
Set them way back,
which, but again, I say that you can set them way back, but they're never out of the game. I've never seen anyone lose every species on the board and not be able to play.
Well, I've been in the last place going to the last turn, and because my entire plan was to score a lot of points on that turn, come back and win going away.
Right.
And did it work out?
Yes.
Okay.
Because I'd set up the board position, thinking ahead, planning where my species were going to be, planning where my support was, and stuff like that.
That's a strange accent you have there.
And certainly, that's something that some people do not like. I know a lot of people, and maybe Robert is one of them, that dislike this game simply because someone can come from so far behind and win going away.
Sure.
Almost randomly.
And you're right. It's unlike Europa, the
Age of Empires 3,
where you can work on your plan. Other people can mess with it by moving position. There's not random events in that game.
Correct.
And my problem is that you can be working on a plan all you want, and people can with you, and I can deal with people with me because I can with, there's given by random events in a game that where you have to strategize. I'm sorry, it's almost like playing Agricola, and if you're not the first person, first two people in line to get the extra baby boy or whatever, you might as well quit the game immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So, I find if really that given how much effort you have to think in this game, to have random events destroy your ability.
The thinking part.
So it's that you put all the effort into thinking, and then it could be completely undone.
By a random event.
But I think that also gives you an opportunity to readjust your strategy, which is what this game does. You, like I said, ebb and flow. Your strategy may change mid-game. You know, something's not working, or something has happened that's thrown you off your strategy. So you go, okay, I need to do something else.
Have to be agile.
Or correct.
Or something happens like the average kill J phase comes along, and guess what? Everybody on you, and you're screwed.
All right, quick sidebar.
Yes?
Tell us about the kill J phase.
No.
I can tell you about the kill J phase. See, when Jay is playing, or Robert, well, it depends on what he's going by these days.
Mostly the wanted posters.
Yes. Yes, correct.
Only in Canada now.
But in every game that he is in, usually we enter what we call the kill J phase, in which everybody piles upon Jay every negative thing that they can do in the game to him. It's been a long-standing tradition, and we plan to continue that tradition in every game. And it certainly works better in war games and things like that, because we can all attack him at the same time. But in the strategy games, you know, killing off his species is good enough.
To say this game is not a war game, I think you're underrating this game. This game is definitely a war game.
There's hexes and everything.
There's hexes and everything, but there's also just trying to kill other players.
Oh, absolutely. But you can say that about any game. I mean,
well, it's not so much you're trying to kill them. You're just trying to limit the spread of their invasive species.
The little Lebensraum?
Yeah. You know, the spiders need more.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. You were the spiders.
From Mars?
Always.
Ziggy. So, you know, and just to go back to another point where Robert said, you know, in Agricola, if your strategy gets messed up early, you don't have as much chance to readjust it, I think, in like a game like Agricola. I think in this game, with the random events, you do have more chance to adjust.
I will grant you that.
And I think that's why I like this game better than,
but they're not really random events. The way that they, the path,
no,
the order they come up in is kind of random, but they're available to be chosen by people. You
right,
know, and then
true.
They apply the effect of the cards.
True.
It's not really random.
You can certainly mitigate the negative impact on your species by taking an event early in the game or late in the game or when it's advantageous for you to do it. So there is a strategy like that. The randomness comes from when they come up. The only one we know is definitely going to come up last. It's the Ice Age card. But all that does is take us into the last scoring phase.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, yeah, like I said, in this game, every card is going to get played at some point. Sometimes they have no effect. Sometimes they wipe the board. But I think you do, in this game, more so than Agricola or Le Havre or a game like that, you do have more chance to come out of that tailspin when that happens to you. Yeah. Agricola, if you get behind, you can get behind, and that's the end.
Now, is that the kind of coming out of your tailspin where you lucked into the right card, or you can be smart and clever about it?
A little bit of both, but I think you can also be smart and clever about it. You can readjust. You can go, okay, I've been banged out of this mountain. My mammals have been beaten. I've lost all my elements. The mountains and the forests are no good to me anymore, so I move on to the wetlands or whatever, and I start scoring more points there, or I readjust, you know, what tiles I'm placing or what where I'm going, whether I'm migrating, whether I'm glaciating, which is another one you can do, and I didn't even touch on that. Glaciating, you can create glaciers. You create the tundra, and as tundra comes, species die. So,
I disagree. I play mostly with Chuck and Rod, so smart and clever obviously doesn't come into play.
So you think luck?
Sheer luck, yes.
To be fair to Robert, outside of his silliness.
For once.
Well, we're always fair to him. He just doesn't see it that way. But is that it is basically at heart, in many ways, just a worker placement game. And, well, it's got all these other elements. A lot of people may find it's got too much added on for a Euro worker placement game,
mm-hmm.
where you might rather just play Pillars of the Earth or,
Stone Age.
Or Stone Age or something like that and get it done in 90 minutes instead of, or an hour
Get your worker placement jollies in 90 minutes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Instead of 3 hours plus.
So it's definitely not for everyone. No, yeah. I agree. And I've played with players that love it, and I've played with players like Robert or Jay that and they are the same person, by the way.
In the same body.
In the same body.
No, we're not.
You never know who's in control.
That's right. That do not like it and just... they'll play it once and never play it again. Never be interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's hardly ever my choice, is
but
it?
But I have to say that this is a Chad Jansen game from GMT, and he just put out Urban Sprawl, and Urban Sprawl is even more chaotic than Dominant Species. So, and maybe in the future we'll take a look at that one.
And isn't there a card game, Urban Sprawl card game, or
there's a Dominant Species,
Card game.
The third edition of this is coming out, Dominant Species. Very soon, February or March from GMT, but also either around that time or right after that time, Dominant Species card game is coming, which from what I've been hearing is it's going to be the general Dominant Species just quicker.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see when it comes out.
Did you P500 it?
I certainly did P500 that one, because I really love Dominant Species. And I like Chad Jensen's game. I also own Urban Sprawl, which I think...
What's P500 mean?
P500 is a
pre-purchase plan
for GMT. They put all their games out on the P500 list, and when they get 500 orders, the games go into the final production phase. And when they get to about 750 to 800 orders or more, they go into the final production phase, and they will charge you, and you will get the game. It's a way for GMT to find out what games really people are interested in getting produced, and a way for them to limit their risks.
To finance it as well.
Finance it and limit their risk. They don't take the money until the game goes into final production and is ready to charge and be shipped. But they're guaranteeing a certain number of sales, and the risk is limited on their part, and it works fantastic. Of course, GMT is mostly a war game company, but they've certainly dipped their toe, and I think successfully, into the Euro game market with both Urban Sprawl and Dominant Species.
Mm-hmm. Both by the same guy.
Both by the same guy, who also did Combat Commander, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a very good...
Which is a very, very popular war game GMT puts out.
Tactical World War II stuff.
Okay, so one comment I've heard about worker placement games is a lot of time you spend the whole game perfecting your engine or your methodology, and then the game's over. Since Dominant Species is longer, does that mean you're in that sweet spot longer, or are you still hitting the sweet spot toward the end?
I think you can hit the sweet spot, go out of it, and hit a different sweet spot. I mean, it's that ebb and flow again. I mean, certain things can happen. You can get your engine going, but I think that with the cards and other people playing the cards as well as you playing the cards and all the cards coming out and the actions and events that happen, it can disrupt your sweet spot. So you have to restart it. And again, that was a good question, Tyler, because I think that also is something I like about this game.
There can be several cycles of that for the players, where you're actually playing a little bit different at different points in the game.
Right.
And you're not just going on a single total strategy of...
Like in Agricola, though, or Age of Empires, I come back to, you know, it's more closely similar to Age of Empires. You know, colonization strategy in Age of Empires, if you're hitting the sweet spot on colonization, you're scoring all your points that way, then that's what you're staying with and you're in it.
Mm-hmm.
Same with...
And isn't that when Chuck buys a bunch of guns and comes over and shoots
you? That's right. And that's a legitimate strategy. There's also the economic strategy.
Never.
In that. Whereas this, you get into a strategy and you're dominating a certain area and something happens and you've got to move or you've got to change your strategy. And I think that makes the game more interesting, at least for me.
Mm-hmm.
So... Overall, it's certainly one of my favorite games to play. Again, it's a little difficult to get out on the table simply because it is a little longer. It can play up to six. The more players, obviously, it takes a little longer.
Can it play two?
It can play two, not as well. I think three is a good minimum number.
I'd say 3 to 5 or something.
3 to 5
is probably
six,
good.
Six gets a little long and six gets a little chaotic, but I think 3 to 5 is a good numbers. 3, 4, and 5.
So most gaming groups would have that many people.
Absolutely. But the nice thing is it can go to six. You know, you get that odd number or that bigger number of players.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to say that based on listening to Rod, he's proven all my points.
You got some?
Points where it's a long, boring game for what it is. A lot of thinking goes into, you have to do a lot of thinking in order to play the game to any successful conclusion without any guarantee that your, all that hard effort gets you anywhere near the end of victory.
But we're talking about you, Robert.
But I think that's true.
If I remember right, of the two games we played of this, I won one of them. So
I can't remember that. Must be one of those dark periods.
And in the second game, I was winning right up till you snatched victory from defeat.
I wish I could say I've won.
Well, you shouldn't carry it in defeat.
But you know, for me, winning is not you know, I always try to win. But
what?
I always try to win.
Try the operative
word. I don't
often
win.
But, there's a reason there's not
if I enjoy the game, I mean, if I enjoy the other things, the theme of the game is great. I really, you get to feel that your species is trying to compete with the other species for domination of the world that you're creating.
You get to bring a little intelligent design to natural selection.
Correct. People will say it's just pasted on theme, but I disagree. I think that the theme is well done in the game.
I will give you that as well. The competition is fierce.
Yes, and the actions allow you to get the feel that you are actually doing things that might have really happened.
Mm-hmm.
I have heard it referred to as a historical game. I don't know if I would call it that, but
prehistorical,
maybe.
So it's a historical game like those people that have either a fish or a fish with feet on the back of their car.
For the ones with the fish with feet.
It's slightly more historical than, say, Guillotine.
Last word on the subject, Robert?
Get a different game out.
Chuck?
I'll play it again.
I certainly will play it again.
Okay.
And just it's not with Jay.
I think you can make them.
I think you may both enjoy that.
Well, it's always fun.
Yeah. So is this still out in print?
Right now it is. It is not. It's coming back into print. The third edition is coming out from GMT, like I said, with different art. And that should be available, I'm going to say, February or March. They'll be coming out with it.
Okay.
And in the words of GMT Kirk, why Spock? Why?
Because it's a very popular game.
That would be a fun promo tile if you have Spock's capsule from Star Trek 3 just land on the board.
Yeah. Or the TARDIS.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing the game doesn't need is a monolith.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. All right, Robert, Chuck, Rod, thank you for talking about Dominant Species.
No problem.
You're welcome.
Whatever.
You've been listening to Carnage Cast, a production of NNEG LLC. All rights reserved. For more information, visit us at www.carnagecon.com.
Stark is going to win if you don't do something.
No, he's not going to win. It's your move.